Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 222, entitled, Everything is Fucked, How to Have More Hope and Happiness in a Chaotic World, I chat with Mark Manson. Mark Manson is the number one New York Times bestselling author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, a world-renowned blogger and entrepreneur, and the author of the newest bestselling hit, Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. In today's episode, Mark talks about why we're all so unhappy despite having more than ever before and what's contributing to this paradox. He covers religion, politics, technology, and the dramatic changes in social behavior over the last few years. Mark also talks about how we can best adapt ourselves to this rapidly changing world we're living in and how we can avoid feeling hopeless and depressed and, more importantly, how we can thrive. If you're wondering how to avoid feeling like all hope is lost and everything is fucked, check this episode out now. I'm telling you, you're going to love it. Hey, are you following me on Instagram yet? If not, you are completely psychotic, but you do have a chance to redeem yourself. Go to Instagram right now and follow at Justin Stenstrom. That's JustinStenstrom. That's right. That's my first and last name. And when you follow me, you'll get day-to-day updates on book recommendations, biohacking tools, elite man know-how, and all the glorious content I probably shouldn't post about, but do anyways. Whether pics of me trying to conquer the world in my personal life or stories about cutting-edge research and technology, I post all the time on Instagram. It's one of my favorite platforms, so you have to be following me to keep up to date on Elite Man know-how. Get your daily dose of Elite Man entertainment and information Sunday through Saturday, Instagram at Justin Stenstrom. Also, you can always click the link in the show notes, which will take you to this link and all other links that we mention here on the Elite Man podcast. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Mark Manson, the author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, and the author of the upcoming book, Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. Mark, thanks so much for coming back on the show, man.
It's good to be back here.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. We had a blast the first time around. I think it was probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. It was right about the time of the release of the first book, so I guess that was like, what, a year and a half ago?
Two and a half years ago.
Oh, shit. 2.5 years ago. Man, time flies.
Time flies, dude.
I just mentioned to you a moment ago, too. I remember you saying before the call that you had an idea that it was going to be a lot bigger than models. Well, it was going to be bigger than models. And at the time, actually, one of your biggest accomplishments was models and, you know, the impact it had on the dating community and for men. And you had an idea that it was going to be pretty big, but I don't think you had any idea that it was going to completely blow up and just be the number one self-help book of the last 2.5 years.
Yeah, it's been insane. I think whatever expectations I had for it, they were just blown apart within a couple months. So it's been amazing.
What do you think has to do with that? What's the biggest reason for its popularity? It's just unbelievable success. What's the number one thing you think?
Well, I mean, not to pat myself too much on the back, but I think it's well written. I think ultimately that's what matters most is like how well a book is written. But I also think it's just, I think with both models and subtle art, I was very good about catching, I guess, where the culture was in terms of like, you know, how everybody was feeling at the time. So I think like with models, I recognized that there were a lot of men out there who wanted to improve their dating relationships, but they wanted to do it in a very like a mature and healthy way, and there wasn't really anything on the market for that. And I think with subtle art, there's a lot of people out there who want to improve their lives, but they don't really buy into all the positivity, and you know, they think the world's kind of sucks a lot of the time, and And they just want to be honest about that. And so I think in both cases, it was about correctly reading the culture and kind of where people were at emotionally and predicting where it was going to go.
Did you have any worries or maybe doubts about its success, given the title and kind of its counterintuitive approach and maybe even just like political incorrectness?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. There was a lot of discussion with my publisher about the F word. And it's actually really funny looking back, because now there's like 15 books with the F word in the title. but it's at that time, it was a really intense discussion of like, what, you know, do we go with it? Do we not? Is it appropriate? I think I was very confident in the material because I'd been blogging for a long time. And I'd seen that the ideas in the book really resonated with a lot of people, but I kind of figured that it would be like a cult favorite, similar to Models, I guess, like very popular within a small kind of group of people. And then everybody else would ignore it. I didn't realize it would be so mainstream.
Yeah, it's funny too that it did catch on like that, and you know how it did, and just blew up to be as popular as it is, and you know, given the title and you know the writing style, which people like me absolutely love, but you know, some other people mainstream, you wouldn't think they love, but I think everybody kind of has that in them, and sometimes they want to just they want to hear the truth, they want to hear it how it's really said it or how it should be said.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think the biggest takeaway is? If you had to just say there's one takeaway from The Subtle Arc, I mean, I know there's so many great things, there really is. What do you think the biggest takeaway is for you?
I think there are two big points I tried to make in that book that I felt were underserved in the self-help world. The first one is the question of values, is this whole idea that it's like, if you value the wrong thing, then it doesn't matter how early you get up, you know, how disciplined you are, how many goals you set. It's like, if your values are wrong, it's just all that stuff's going to hurt you. So it's almost like not even worth talking about all the other stuff until you've had the discussion about values. And then the second thing is I remember the reason I started writing that book was I felt very, very strongly that there needed to be a self-help book about pain and the importance of pain and the importance of like enduring it. Cause I felt like that was something, everything else at the time, it was all about avoiding pain, like, you know, getting away from pain. And so I wanted to write a book that was like, hey man, you know, you got to dive, you got to go into it. You can't go, the only way to overcome your pain is by going through it. So yeah, I think that those two things are like the big takeaways from that book.
I'd agree. I mean, they're both incredibly important, and you know, especially the pain aspect of it too. So many people in self-help books in the self-help field tend to avoid that or stay away from it or pretend like you don't have to face pain to actually get through challenges and be the type of person you want to be, whatever it is that you're facing. And you know, you kind of very clearly and distinctly outline that problem and in fact in the book. And you know, I think it's one of the reasons why it's so successful. Is Everything Is Fucked, is that a sequel to the book in some respects?
Kind of. I've been calling it like an expansion of Subtle Art, which I don't know, maybe that's just me being having my head up my ass, but it's it's a lot of the same principles, but I think they're just applied deeper and more broadly. So for instance, you know, there's a lot of Everything Is Fucked is, it's still about values, and it's still about pain, but it's, instead of being focused more on the individual, it's a deeper look at, it's a deeper look at our culture and how these tendencies are affecting, you know, our communities, our workplaces, our relationships, and even our politics. So I was very nervous about, you know, I don't, everything, it seems like everything these days is like fucking political.
Yeah.
and but I really try to stay above that and not get involved with it. But at the same time, I thought it was really important to write about why it seems like everything today is becoming political, and like what the forces behind that are. And I ultimately, you know, that comes down to values. We live in a weird time where our values are being skewed or amplified or warped in a lot of strange ways. And so, you know, the new book is my attempt to grapple with that and understand it.
Hmm. So what is your biggest takeaway then on the new book? What do you think really kind of sums it up in a couple of sentences?
So the new book, it's similar to Subtle Art in that it's like Subtle Art. The title, people see the title like Subtle Art, Not Giving a Fuck, and they're like, oh man, I wish I didn't give a fuck. Like, wow, my life's so stressful. And then you open the book, like that gets you to buy the book, and then you actually open it and start reading and you get the whole message of like, oh, you have to give a fuck about something, and you know you're just picking the wrong things, and it's kind of. You know, I had a friend who used to describe it as like, you promise people candy and then give them vegetables. And so I kind of tried to do that again with the new book by, essentially, I think there's a lot of people out there who are struggling with a sense of hope in the world, both with themselves, but also their communities, their countries, everything. And I think they're desperately looking for that hope somewhere. And so that's, you know, that would get them to buy this book. But basically the book quickly argues that it's that same constant desire for hope that is making things worse. It's this constant need to believe that everything is going to be great and amazing if just X, Y, and Z happen that is actually causing more pain and conflict in the world. So that's the big mind fuck coming down the pipeline.
So do you talk about hope being good at all in the book? Is there any place for hope in our lives, or is it just totally, you know, fuck hope and, you know, actually focus on the tangible concrete shit?
I think it's a little bit of the latter. The way I end up describing hope is very similar to love, actually, is that, people assume that it's always a positive thing. You know, nobody says anything bad about love. Like love is supposed to be like the best thing ever. And it's kind of the same thing with hope, but but if you really look at it, love can be very dangerous and hurtful. That there's like healthy forms of love that make life great and worth living. And then there's very unhealthy forms of love that cause our biggest pain. And I make the argument that hope is very similar. If you look at all the best things in life, a lot of them they come from maintaining a sense of healthy hope. But if you look at all the worst things that happen in the world, they are also motivated by a sense of hope. And so we need to be very, very careful what we hope for, essentially. Like what are those visions of the future that we construct for ourselves that we choose to believe in? And yeah, my argument ends up being that we kind of need to just, similar to love, it's like, you know, I've been advising guys for years now that it's like, love is great, but don't trust it completely. Like you need to be able to sit down and kind of think rationally about, you know, whether somebody's good for you or not. I think the same thing is true with our hopes and our beliefs, that we need to, you know, they're great, but we need to step back and be very careful about how they're going to affect us and affect the world.
Yeah. What have you found when people have too much hope and that's really what they're banking on for changing their life?
I think so. If people who just go all in on hope, they become extremists, and I mean extremist in every sense of the word. You know, it could be right wing, left wing. They could be, you can be an interpersonal extremist. So you can be a, you know, one of those obsessive dudes who just like, is constantly blowing up his girl all day, every day, and like obsessed with everything she does. Like, that's a form of extremism. That's putting all of your hope in a single person. So I think it's my argument is that extremism in all forms is dangerous, because it's when we only have hope in one thing, it means we're willing to destroy pretty much everything else to get that thing. And, you know, so it's we need to hold our hope lightly and also understand that hope can come from a lot of different places. Like, there's never one single thing that is going to make our life amazing.
Mark, what is your take in the book on politics and also religion and sort of the intertwinement of the two in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, last decade or so?
So when I was researching, when I was doing all this research into, I guess I should back up a little bit and talk about, you know, kind of what the inspiration for talking about hope in the first place was that I noticed that, you know, there's a rising kind of, some people call it an epidemic, but there's a rising issue, like mental health crisis going on in a lot of the developed world. And what's interesting is that a lot of these mental health issues, depression, anxiety, suicide, drug addiction, they're not rising among like the lower classes. They're rising among the affluent. And that's a very unexpected thing, and it's never really happened before. And so I became very curious about that. And then at the same time, you just see, like, you know, anybody who spends 10 minutes on Twitter just sees how like fucking awful everything seems all the time. And I was just asking myself these questions of like, why is this? Why is everybody, if everything's great, you know, like things are better than they've ever been. So why is everybody feeling this way? And one of the first things I came across that was super interesting is that if you look at religiosity, you know, over the last 100 years or so, it's basically been declining pretty much nonstop, like the last 50 years. You know, if you go back 50 years ago, it's like 90% of people went to church or, you know, synagogue or whatever their religion was. And today it's like 30 or 40%. And then at the same time, I've noticed that there's a lot of religious type behavior around other things in our society. So there's, I think the most obvious example is politics. Politics has taken a much more religious tone over the last few decades than it did in the past. And I think that's true on both sides of the political spectrum. Corporations have taken on, like, if you look at like shit like Apple, or people who are like big fans of Nike, celebrity culture has taken on a very religious characteristic over the last few decades. And so it became very interesting to me that it's not necessarily that we're becoming less religious. It's just that we're putting our faith in different things. And then that got me asking the question, you know, what is it that determines where we choose to find faith, or where we choose to find hope? Because essentially hope is a faith of a better future, a faith that something is going to make my life better. And so the biggest challenge of the book ended up being having a conversation about religious and politics without ever picking a side myself. Obviously I do have a side, like I do have my personal and my personal political and religious beliefs, but I needed to write the book in such a way that, that side is never clear. And so that was a huge challenge. But I also thought it was really, really important because I feel like there's a real lack of discussion on this topic that isn't politicized. You know, there are people on the right who talk about this and the people on the left who talk about this, but they always talk about it through their own lens. And I wanted to try to like zoom out and catch everything.
Yeah, it's very interesting conversation too, and I didn't, you know, made a couple of points that I didn't even realize as far as people 100%, it's, you know, 100% true, 90% or whatever the exact number is, a ridiculous number of people 50 years ago used to go to church or synagogue or mosque, whatever it is, and worship their God. But now it's dramatically fallen. The numbers have fallen. But like you said, it's not like their religion has really changed or they don't have these beliefs anymore. They've just shifted them into different things. And again, I think the biggest thing is politics. That like these people, you go on social media, any page, any day on social media, you can just see so many threads of people talking shit to each other about, you know, Republicans are right or Democrats are right or Trump's an asshole or Hillary's an asshole. And it's just back and forth nonstop. And you think about it too, sometimes like you can see, and of course I have my side too, you know, I choose to kind of stay away from it on the podcast, but you know, I have a side that I typically tend to agree with more than the other. Although I will say that I try to consciously avoid, I think like you do, picking one side and then becoming an extremist in those views, because I think both sides can have right arguments from time to time. They can both be right, but if you're so far down one end, you can't see that the other person is right or that the other side actually has a good point, because you're so indoctrinated into that belief or that religion that your side is right or that the only side is the side that you're on, of the people that you hang around and the people you talk to and agree with most of the time, whether that be Republican or Democrat. But yeah, you're right, man. It's a very fascinating link. And I think so many people, unfortunately, don't have that realization that what they're actually doing is following into a religion. And in this case, it's politics.
It's hard. And one of the things that I talk about later in the book is that I think, you know, there's all this discussion now about social media and so much discussion of, like, you know, usually the discussions are pretty superficial. It's like, well, Facebook is like ruining news and like Twitter makes people depressed. And I find those arguments a little bit simplistic, and there's not a ton of, like, the data is pretty mixed. What I do think the technology does is that I think it promotes, it unintentionally promotes kind of a myopic view. It promotes extremism without even intending to do it. And it does that by showing you people who are like-minded, showing you it's optimized for showing you content that's going to trigger the most emotional reaction out of you. And then it's going to immediately place you in a group of people who completely agree with you. And it's just, there's a lot of data that shows that when you remove the diversity of people that you're exposed to, it makes people, more basically exhibit more extremist beliefs. And then two, when you remove that face-to-face interaction, like this is the thing that is always crazy to me, is that I'll be online. I think everybody's had this experience where it's like you're online, you see somebody post something that you disagree with, and you just immediately, like, you get angry and you're just like, that person's a fucking idiot and I'm going to tell them exactly why, you know, and you just start launching into this thing. And then like, say like a month later, I'll be at like a family gathering, it'll be like a holiday or something, and I'll like go talk to my aunt, and my aunt will have that exact same view that I thought was like so stupid and anger inducing online. But in person, I'll start talking to her and it's like, no, we actually have a really good conversation about our different views. And, you know, what I notice is that it softens both of us. Like, whereas online, it like, when I see somebody I disagree with, it makes me double down on my own beliefs. In person, if I talk to somebody I disagree with, it softens my own viewpoints and it makes me become more skeptical of myself and be like, oh, well, you know, maybe I'm off here. Maybe she's got a point. Maybe I'm like overreacting. And I think there's a lot to be said for nonverbal communication and the necessity of in-person interactions generating empathy with people and generating a real sense of connection. And I think when you look at all the data about things like loneliness and depression and social anxiety, a lot of those rise because we're depriving ourselves of face-to-face interactions. We're interacting with fewer and fewer people face-to-face than ever before. So it's a weird time, man. It's one, you know, one way I think about it is that all this technology the last couple of decades, we basically traded in quality of relationships for quantity. And that's pretty much affecting everything.
Hey, have you checked out our Elite Man YouTube channel yet? If not, get on it right now. Go to EliteManMagazine.com/YouTube and start watching our fantastic videos. We cover everything from dating, health, business, fitness, confidence, mindset, social skills, everything that you need to know to be a 21st century elite man, we've got you covered. We have a new video coming out every Monday and Friday, and I'm telling you, this is the number one place to get your elite man fix and the number one place to grow as a man. These videos will absolutely change your life and entertain you at the same time. I'm telling you, check these videos out right now. I have so much fun putting them together. I know you're going to absolutely love them. EliteManMagazine.com/YouTube. Make sure you check it out right now and subscribe to our channel to get more of these fantastic videos and get notified the instant we release a new video. EliteManMagazine.com/YouTube.
Yeah. And you make so many good points right there too with, you know, you see your aunt and talking to her on social media and sometimes you'll disagree with that on and then you see them, or sometimes, like you said, you kind of agree with them and you can hash it out or talk about it a little better in person. But there's so much lost when you're on the internet, when you're on Facebook or Instagram or whatever other social media, and you're trying to talk to people. Like you said, you don't have that, you don't have the body language and the tone of voice and all the other things that go into communicating with someone. You just have the words that are on a screen, and you can take that interpretation in so many different ways. And I think, like you said, a lot of it's lost when you don't have that in person. Another thing too is I tend to find that, or I've noticed over the last few years, that when people disagree in on the computer, on Facebook, especially Facebook and, you know, Twitter, in terms of politics and stuff, but when they disagree on something like politics, so many relationships can be lost and so many friendships can be lost because of just a disagreement online, as opposed to, like you said, if you have that disagreement in person, a lot of the times you're finding a common ground. You can actually see where the other person's coming from, and a lot of emotion is kind of kept out of it. Yeah, it might get a little heated in person, but it seems like, you know, there's so much more that can be done when you're talking to somebody in person, as opposed to just trying to, you know, have a debate over the internet. And I think maybe because it's public as well, people have like this idea that they have to be right and they have to prove you wrong. And it gets like worse because there's other people that can see it, as opposed to just talking with someone one-on-one. I mean, I don't know, man, it has been pretty crazy though, in that respect.
Yeah. It's been weird. And, you know, to even pull it out of politics, I think you see this, in terms of like dating relationships nowadays too. One of the most common questions and discussions I have with readers who are asking for dating advice, it's all about like living in the age of Tinder. And it's funny because it's the same sort of stuff is happening in that domain too, where it's, you know, people get on Tinder and they, you know, they swipe a bunch of times. And they start disqualifying people for like really superficial and stupid reasons. They're like, oh, well, you know, she went to school here, and I'm not really interested in girls who are like from that place, or her hair is too short. And it's like, you have no idea how you're going to feel with somebody until you're actually sitting face to face with them and having like a genuine conversation. But again, the technology has, A, it gives us the perception of having endless options. So there's almost no downside to like rejecting somebody anymore. And then B, it objectifies everything about a person. So you don't actually get that empathic face-to-face connection when you're interacting with them. And so it's funny, I talk to so many men and women who are just like constantly frustrated that they have tons and tons and tons of low quality, you know, short dates with tons of people, and like none of them lead anywhere. And it's like such a strange thing for me, because thankfully I met my wife before these apps came out.
Yeah, man. So yeah, I mean, Tinder especially, it's the most superficial of all superficial apps out there. I think it's literally just looking at someone and, you know, their face and a few pictures and determining if you're going to be compatible with them or if they're a good person or not. And it's like, you know, swipe left, swipe right, or, you know, over the stupidest thing, short hair, whatever dumb shit that they say in their profile. I mean, it's just, and then the profile is like, you know, 10 words, that's it. But I mean, you can't really judge too much from a Tinder profile. I don't know. The age that we're living in, the technological age, it's really changing things like so fast. I think faster than anybody can really keep up with. It's just technology over the last decade. Even when, you know, when I first got out of high school and got into college, like 10 years ago, from then to now, it's just ridiculous. I think POF, Plenty of Fish, was like the first app or dating thing that was around back then. And even looking at that now, like compared to Tinder, it's so different. And I don't know, man. You're right. The game is changing so fast. Dating game's changing, and it's making it harder in some respects too for a lot of guys, especially guys who aren't like very attractive or physically good looking.
Yeah, I think it's just everywhere. You know, whether it's dating, relationships, whether it's news, whether it's politics, whether it's our community, our like interactions with our local community, everything. We're trading in a small amount of quality interactions and relationships for a vast quantity of low quality interactions and relationships. And I think that has very, very real consequences on us as individuals. And I think that also has very real consequences on us as a culture. And basically the big take home message I arrive at in the book is like, A, it's the in the 21st century, the name of the game is actually limitation. It's not having more, knowing more. It's choosing the few things that you're going to give a fuck about. And B, it's focusing more on fewer in-person high quality relationships and interactions and less on just this like sea of nonsense that's always going on out there in the digital world.
Why does having this greater connectivity, being connected to, you know, 500-600 friends on Facebook, more, sometimes it's 5,000 friends on Facebook, having this greater connectivity to other people actually make us hate each other more, aside from the politic aspect of it and some of the other issues we talked about? What is the overall reason that you think being more connected is actually making us not like each other?
I think there's a few psychological things that happen to us that, and look, like I think Silicon Valley had very, very good intentions. I mean, if you think back to like 2005 or whatever, it's like in Facebook, you know, was started all this stuff by saying we're going to connect the planet and everybody's going to be able to interact with everybody else. Like, that sounds amazing. Like, on paper, that sounds like a really, really, really good thing. I think a few things happened. One is just there's a very real phenomenon in human psychology called paradox of choice, which is essentially the more options you give somebody, like let's say you can choose from 20 different breakfast cereals. On the surface, that seems better than being able to choose between two breakfast cereals. It's like you have more options, you have more freedom, you have more opportunity. But an interesting thing happens is that the more options you give people, the less they value any specific choice. So if you give somebody 20 breakfast cereals to choose from, whatever they choose, they're going to value it much less than the person who you just give two options. This is called the paradox of choice, is that the more opportunity and optionality you give people, the less valuable any given choice it feels to that person. So if you're able to immediately contact every single person you've ever met over the last 15 years, suddenly those points of contact feel very insignificant and pointless. It's like think about it this way, you know, our parents' generation, if you ran into, say, your old college roommate or something at the grocery store, like that was a big event. Like I was like, oh my God, like, holy shit, it's been 10 years. Like, wow, look at you. Oh, you're married now. That's amazing. You know? And it would actually, it would probably precipitate, a really good social interaction. You'd probably want to hang out with them again, catch up sometime, whatever. In this day and age, it's like, if I ran into my college roommate, I'd be like, oh, hey, dude, congrats on the new job, you know, like whatever. And then I'd like go about my business. So there's this paradoxical thing where that I don't think the Silicon Valley people expected, which is that the more you connect and network people, the less they're going to value, the less valuable each of those individual relationships will feel. And because they feel less valuable, there will be a less sense of intimacy and connection with each individual person. So again, the way I prefer to describe it is that we're trading in a small amount of very high quality connections for an infinite amount of meaningless connections. And that sounds good on paper. Like if you're a computer programmer or an investor somewhere, like, you know, it's like, oh shit, yeah, that's great. People love more stuff. But it's more doesn't always make us psychologically healthier or happier. So that's just one of the issues. I mean, we talked about the dehumanization. You know, it's like you can't see a person's face. You know, you just see some stupid thing they said on Twitter and you just immediately assume they're an awful person and you feel completely justified in judging them and assuming all sorts of shit about their lives that you would never do in person, ever, ever, ever. I feel this, you know, I've blogged for 10, 15 years. Like I feel this all the time. I get emails from people that I am shocked. I'm like, it's stuff that you would never say to my face ever. Like it's so inappropriate, but there's something about being online that they feel completely justified in saying that to a stranger. I think what's happened the last few years is that the honeymoon period with the internet is over. We're as a culture, we're starting to realize a lot of the drawbacks to these technologies. We're starting to feel a lot of the costs and sacrifices of them. I think as a society, we need to start learning how to like cope, with this stuff. And then I guess that's what I'm trying to help do with this next book.
Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of good points in there as well. And, I think too, when you say that the, paradox of choice, we have too many options. It's almost like I think everybody can relate to having Netflix or something similar to that, where you're literally scrolling around for like an hour trying to find what to watch.
You're like, man, Netflix doesn't have anything to watch anymore, you know, and it's like 800 shows.
Yeah. And then, you know, you're with your girlfriend or something or your friend and you're trying to find something. You're literally spent like an hour and a half trying to find something where you could have just picked something and actually watched a whole movie or show in that time. It's ridiculous. Yeah. But I mean, we can all relate to something like that. And I think it's so true, especially when it comes to social media and our friends. And also something else comes to mind, which is the old phrase, the absence makes the heart grow fonder, which is, you know, totally true. The more that we see people, the more we kind of, you know, get sick of them. After a certain period of time, we kind of get sick of seeing them over and over again. Whereas, like you said, back in the day, if you bump into a college roommate or an old friend, it's great. You're like so happy to see them and catch up to them. Now, if you go to the gym and bumped into that same friend, it's like you're hiding your face because you just saw them on social media posting a bunch of shit.
Yeah, you're like, oh, I don't want to talk right now.
Yeah, maybe tomorrow I'll see them anyways on social media. Yeah. So it's like, you know, you don't have that worry of not seeing them. What do you think contributes most? Because you mentioned this too earlier in the beginning of the episode. What do you think is contributing most to people getting more anxious and depressed in the 21st century, in this technological age that we live in? Is it, I mean, I'm sure social media and some of these other factors have a part of it, have something to do with it. But what in your mind, because I know you talk about this in the upcoming book, what in your mind is the biggest reason that people are getting more and more anxious and depressed despite the advances in so much health and technology and, you know, healthcare in general?
I think the primary cause is loneliness, is lack of face-to-face social exposure. There's a lot of interesting research that's been done like the last 10 years or so, basically showing the emotional benefits of spending an extended amount of time in person with somebody that you cannot get through a screen. It's just your brain just does not react the same way. Like the same emotional fulfillment doesn't occur even if you spend the same amount of time with somebody online versus in person. And so I think it's, we're seeing an erosion of these in-person relationships. And I think that, people have always underestimated how integral personal relationships are to both physical and emotional health. Dude, like social isolation is less healthy for you than smoking. A smoker will die later than somebody who is socially isolated. There's a lot of like very harrowing statistics and studies and stuff that I talk about in the book, but one of them is that they did this survey back in like the 1980s, and they asked people, they said, how many people do you have in your life right now that you would trust with a personal secret? And back then the average answer was 3 people. Today, they ran that same survey about 5 years ago. The most common answer was 0.
Wow.
Which that kind of tells you everything you need to know right there. It's people aren't getting that same social exposure that they used to get. They're not building the intimacy. They're not building the trust. And so they don't feel, you know, it's like we're being starved in a sense. It's very consistent when you limit people's relationships, meaningful relationships, they become very anxious. Because think about it. It's like if you, like, let's say going to work, like talking to somebody at work is the only social, like face-to-face social experience you have every day. That is going to feel extremely stressful and cause a lot of anxiety. Whereas if you're talking to people face to face constantly and you have, you know, family at home and you hang out with your neighbors all the time, then you're not going to feel any anxiety in that situation. And it's similar with depression. Depression's more an issue with meaning. I call it a crisis of hope. But it's similar. It's like, if you have nobody in your life that seems to give a shit what you're doing, then it's very hard to maintain a sense that your life matters, you know, that it's worth getting up in the morning. So I think the relationship thing is like that's the crux of most of this stuff.
I think you nailed it too with the importance of getting that face-to-face interaction as opposed to just thinking you're communicating or connecting with people via social media or online in some other form. It's kind of like the argument of porn versus real sex. Like you can
totally, that's another great example. Yeah,
you can watch porn all day long, but you're never going to be really fulfilled. In fact, it's probably going to harm you in a lot of ways. And yeah, you're probably going to develop some kind of like dopamine driven addiction to the stimuli that's going on constantly when you flip from one porn video to the next and do it for half an hour, whatever.
Totally.
It's ridiculous. So that's another thing. It's another problem that I think people are being exposed to more and more.
Yeah, it's the same dynamic. We're replacing a few high quality sexual experiences with an abundance of low quality sexual experiences. So it's the same dynamic at play.
What do you think is how do you counteract that? How do you fight that if you're listening right now and you're trying to actually have more connection with other human beings? What do you recommend? Do you talk about this in the book at all, like some actual practical steps for people to take and get themselves unplugged from the digital world and actually like more unplugged with the real world?
Yeah. So self-limitation, first of all, limiting your information, limiting your social media time, being very clear, who you want in your life and then committing to like putting the effort in to make sure that those are good relationships. Same thing with, you know, hobbies or work, being very clear of like what activities matter to you and then putting in the commitment. I think it's really just about, and I talk about this in the book, I think it's just throughout history, it was more was always better, you know, because everybody, all of human history, we live with such scarcity that more was always better. And so that's just always been the operating assumption of human culture. And I think we've probably hit an inflection point where there's just so much stuff and so much, so many people and connections and everything that we need to reverse that. And it's like less is more, and less is more in pretty much all these domains. And so it's just, I think it's a skill set that we need to start developing as a culture of like limiting yourself, limiting your time, paying attention to what you're paying attention to, essentially.
What are some of the biggest assumptions you talk about in the book as far as living a worthwhile life that people have totally mixed up? Like they have it completely wrong. They think they're chasing after something. They think they're doing the things in their life every day that are going to make them happy, but are actually totally off and completely wrong.
I think the, you know, in Subtle Art, I made this distinction between happiness and highs. And I think people kind of the simplest mistake that most people make is they mistake highs for happiness. And, you know, simple examples of that is like making more money or dating more girls or whatever. It's just things that give you like that rush. There's nothing wrong with highs, but they can't be the primary thing motivating you in your life. So I think that's still kind of like the central issue. I think highs are much more easily marketed to people. They're easy. They're more profitable. They're more fun. They're more interesting. They're sexy. They get a lot of attention. And so it's incumbent on us to start developing a culture that is able to discipline ourselves in relation to them.
Mark, I want to wrap things up in a moment, but I did want to ask you, who are your favorite writing influences, either in the past or even modern day, if you have any modern day?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I'll just start throwing out a lot of my favorite authors. Like, cool. just no rhyme or reason. These are just names of some of my favorite guys. I'm a big fan of in terms of like writing in smart nonfiction. I love Steven Pinker. I love Jonathan Haidt. I used to be a huge fan of Ken Wilber, who's a philosopher who wrote a lot in the 80s and 90s. Big fan of Leo Tolstoy. Some of Hemingway's stuff is awesome. I guess I'll stop there. I could keep going for like an hour, but those are kind of like, those are some of my favorites.
Cool. Mark, again, it's been an awesome interview, man. Really do appreciate it. What is a last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, and then a place that our listeners can check out your new book?
Be careful what you hope for. How about that?
Interesting. Cool. And the upcoming book, where can they find it?
Everything is Fucked, the book about hope, is out May 14th. It's probably already out when you hear this, but if not, you should pre-order it. It is available absolutely everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everything. I mean, it's going to be everywhere. So shouldn't have any trouble getting it. Website's markmanson.net. Got hundreds of blog articles there, so check that out as well.
Awesome. Oh, lastly, what are your predictions for this book? Is it going to outdo the Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck?
I can't imagine it possibly outdoing Subtle Art, just because Subtle Art is just so astronomically high in terms of like sales and everything. I think it'll do well, but I'm definitely expecting it to not do as well as Subtle Art. And I'm cool with that.
Cool, man. Well, I hope it does outdo Subtle Art. I know it's a tough task, but I think you got an awesome upcoming book, man. I'm looking forward to going through it myself. Mark, thanks again for coming on, man. Really appreciate it. And take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Justin.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.